Welcome to Plant Power. This is episode 2. After spending the afternoon on a 600-acre organic farm in Wisconsin, my co-host Sarah sat down with scientists Eric Jackson and Brandon Metzger to talk about plants, their genetics, and how to improve genetic material without genetic modifications. And don't forget to keep listening after the interview to hear from practitioner Dave Hogshead about how plants and plant genetics can be useful in practice.
All right, I'm so excited to be here today with Dr. Brandon Metzger and Dr. Eric Jackson. And we're going to talk about some history of plants and how we can improve plant genetics without GMOs and get to that. So first, Eric, can you give me a little background about how your process of what you're doing is different than what people think of GMOs?
Right, Sarah. Yeah. So if you look at like GMO, genetically modified organisms, right? And so when you think about a GMO, you think about how it's created, right? And so the way that's done is you know, and originally was done is people find genetic elements, the DNA is transcribed and then translated into proteins, and then proteins become the building blocks of the things we see and that we touch and we eat and we ingest and everything else. And so what they've done is they found those genetic mechanisms that control specific production of specific proteins that become the metabolites and the different elements and things that we eat. And so what they do, if the plant doesn't make that, doesn't have that, then they insert that into the plant using predominantly a technology that's from a bacterium. So there's a bacterium in nature that was actually able to insert DNA into a host. So they would use that technology, or they just bombard a cell with the fragments and they go into the cell and get recombined into the actual genetic material of that organism, that host organism. And then they start producing that compound that it normally couldn't produce with alien DNA, and DNA meaning alien DNA from another source, not inherently in the plant. And so when you think about the way we're doing things in nature, the plant has its genetic makeup, and then over time, it will evolve through natural selection, the process of natural selection. So there's pressures that are placed onto the plants. And then when those pressures are placed onto the plants, then the plants go through selection. What are they selecting for? Selecting for differences in their genetic makeup that allow them to turn off genes or turn on genes, mostly turn off genes, that will then result in a change in the plant that allows them to overcome something. And a lot of times those things that allow them to overcome something, it changes the chemical composition of the plant in some way. But the genes are there. They're just either being turned on or turned off in nature. And so when we think about that from a whole, plant breeding on the other side has taken advantage of that, where the human being has become the accelerator of that natural selection. And this has happened for thousands and thousands of years from agrarian societies where you have a very diverse set of material in nature, and then they take that diverse set of material and then they grow that and they start selecting on it. And then they can cross-pollinate that between two lines that they really, really like, or put it in proximity. And then the pollen from one plant will pollinate the pistil of another plant, and then you get offspring. And then they look at that and they select the best offspring. Mm-hmm. And they keep doing that over thousands of years. And then you narrow the genetic diversity within that crop species for a very specific reason. And that could be drought tolerance or disease or pest resistance. And it hasn't been, if you think about thousands of years, it really hasn't been something of knowledge where they've done this in a way for nutrition.
Right.
So that has been unselected in a lot of ways. In some cases, though, when you go after these traits for like higher yields, what we've seen and what we've learned is that what you can actually do is turn off some of the mechanisms that would mobilize a lot of the nutrient-dense compounds that are in leaves and in stems, convert those into sugar, and then push that into the seed, and the seed will then get plumper because it turns that sugar into its easiest source, like a carbohydrate or an oil. And so that's one of the selection processes that happened that we've learned early on in crop development, and probably dating back thousands and thousands of years to agrarian time. So probably some old farmer said, hey, look, this seed's more plump And what he didn't realize, it was a mutation in one gene that turned off a lot of other pathways that enabled all the good nutrient-dense things to go into the seed in favor of something that pushed only sugar through and made it, I would like to say, a simpler organism, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's resulted in a lot of our row crops today being a lot less nutrient-dense. And that's kind of now the backbone of all of plant breeding. So now what people have done is now they've gone and said, well, let's go to the GMO route, right? Because we don't have thousands of years to reverse that. So let's just insert this genetic material, which would then give us this end trait. And most of that has been done with herbicide tolerance, pest resistance. Those are the big ones. I mean, there has been the use of this for greater goods like golden rice, right? I mean, and that's a very compelling story, actually, where it was used for good, right? For some real good, right? Whereas the other ones, although they accelerate agriculture and help make agriculture easy, we don't really know the impact of that technology broader on the planet and other things like that, as we're adding more Roundup into the environment. So I'd say, and so that's the route people have used based on that, where we're kind of taking that argument to say, let's go back and say, well, what if we went back now and went back to that diversity that thousands of years ago that farmer started with, but use now a more knowledge base of how this genetic information works, and then use that to accelerate and optimize how we take the old way of bringing pollen over to a pistil and making a new sibling and selecting that with more precision and technology, which is not a genetic modification.
So Brandon, you know, as you're looking at this, you know, what are the things, I mean, you're not selecting for the macronutrients, but you're selecting for some of the phytonutrients, right? And so how, you know, would that apply and what kind of work that you're doing?
Right. So a really exciting opportunity when you start to think about, you know, changes in genetics that have important nutritional endpoints. So, you know, as Eric was saying, you know, most of the breeding to date has been for the benefit of bushels per acre or for the economic profitability of farming. And we're taking a different approach. We are looking at optimizing the genetic potential in a plant or seed for its nutritional content, which is a totally different approach. And so now you can begin to think about developing your own lines or strains of plants at a level that we can actually farm on a large scale to produce, you know, supplements. So currently we're kind of limited by what's available in the marketplace for crops optimized for profitability. Or else on the other end, you have a very small niche market, maybe for garden catalogs that don't have, you know, the volume of seed or haven't really been optimized for its nutritional content. So this really allows us to develop crops and strains targeted for specific clinical endpoints that we're interested in.
Interesting. So, you know, Eric, as you kind of think about how, or I think of it as a naive person to somewhat of this topic about heirloom, I personally love heirloom products because I think they have so much more, you know, diversity in their taste profiles and some of those components. So how does this match with heirlooms, or is it totally not matching with heirlooms at all?
No, I think heirloom's the definition, right, Sarah? And I think what's really important to remember, I mean, I really do enjoy history to a large degree. And we talked about this, and I always talk about this, right? No matter where I go, it's when you think about what we do, it's like right after the Revolution, right? Right after, you know, Washington and Adams and John and Jefferson and Hancock and after they did what they did in the Revolution, it wasn't 2 to 3 years later that Thomas Jefferson was traveling the world. And if you ever go to his farm in Monticello, it's amazing. And on the wall of one of his walls in his farms, and he says, there's no greater good that a man or woman that you could say, there's no greater good that a man or woman could add to a culture than to provide a useful crop to its future. And that's like engraved on his wall, right? And that actually comes from a memoir he wrote like 3 years after our independence. And he was in Africa and he was coming back and he was making the case that we should be building up the genetic potential of the crops that we eat within our country or bring it back to the country. And he was making very specific claims about rice, and the pestilence that was taking over the rice cultivars that were in the country. And he had sent back some rice cultivars that he had found in North Africa, and they were actually combating, they were actually resistant to the pestilence. And he was making this claim at that point when he said that, that he was understanding that these ancient heirloom varieties that exist around the world, that are in the centers of origin from where these things come from, that haven't been selected on, are what a country needs to build its future on. And he was a massive proponent of that, right? And so he pushed that we should have educational systems, that we should have land grant systems, that we should have collections of these crops within our country to build our future on, or our future would be in jeopardy. And so it wasn't until 100 years later that Abraham Lincoln actually took advantage of that and established land grant institutions and a national small grains and national vegetables and these repositories for all these seeds, and sent out like plant pioneers into the world to go bring all these back to the United States. And I think the United States, out of all countries, has one of the greatest like assets in the world, where they have these global seed collections where we've sent people out to go get, whether it's soybean, whether it's maize, whether it's oats, wheat, you know. And this comes back to me in my days at the USDA, when I actually worked at the National Small Grains Repository. After the conflict in Afghanistan, they were actually taking wheat back to Afghanistan and repopulating some of the wheats that were there because they were lost during the war. And so you think about that when you talk about heirloom, what you're saying is right. It's like, we have these rich warehouses of seeds from all over the world, from very raw. And these were pioneers that would go into the side and they would see these things laying in the ditch and they would make a collection, or they'd go into an old seed market and they'd grab a bunch. And these were things that people in these small farming communities all around the world were collecting themselves, or they were right there in the wild. And they've maintained these over the years, right? Since the mid-1800s, you know. You kind of think about what that means. And so they exist there, and they're a powerful treasure to start moving on, especially now that we have the advent of genetic technologies, the ability to actually see into to peel open, I say, the leaves and peel down into the cells and look inside the cells and be able to read the DNA and start to understand the DNA. And we can now utilize that technology with these amazing seed storehouses of these heirloom varieties that are rich in all these nutrients, but they're segregating. They're different. All these thousands of lines have different levels of all these. And then, as Brandon was saying, now we can tailor breed these things with that kind of mindset, and then develop those specifically for what you're doing, what's happening here. And so it gives us the building blocks to start from, right? That you wouldn't have if you started in very adapted agriculture, things out of garden seed catalogs, or at some of the big seed companies, right, which are not heirloom, right?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So if you take like something, like if you take it to a plant level now, so something like buckwheat, which is a unique kind of ingredient to begin with, right? People aren't growing buckwheat everywhere. But we know some of our phytochemistry already that it's rich in certain things like rutin. So can you go and look across and even make it richer in phytonutrients?
Yeah, we're studying that right now. So one of the cool things that we've done, and we're starting to take notice in this, is we have amassed a global seed set of buckwheat, both Esculentum and Tartary, which are the two species. Mm-hmm. And we have sequenced the genetic code of every one of those species. And now we have planted them out and we're measuring these traits on them, starting with the agronomic traits. That's what we started with as we grow them out in two locations, very different, one on the farm here and one on our farm in Idaho. And we've been looking at this very in-depthly and seeing like the heirloom structure of these and just seeing the massive differences that we see from an agronomic perspective, which gets me totally excited, right? And I see this as, I know now we can start to understand the genetics of buckwheat like that we've never been able to understand before. One of our colleagues said that today we're going to have the largest experiment and understanding of buckwheat than anybody in the world. And that's actually true, because I can tell you we talk in the tech world of, you know, we went from like megabytes to gigabytes to terabytes. We have terabytes of genetic information on these 277, 300, 400 lines. We have terabytes and terabytes of information, the genetic information. We put all that together and we've compared all that. And now we're pairing that in our machine to understand what is driving what from the genetics to the agronomics. And then we're passing that in to Brandon and his team, and they're able to do the deep nutrient dive into each one of these materials. And we'll be able to pair that information with that too. And that will help us decide, okay, which lines are best for and optimized for these outputs, and how do we develop the new lines from that starting material that can optimize everything that the consumer needs or wants within the work that Brandon's team is doing. So it's really exciting, actually. It's exciting to do that.
So Brandon, how something like buckwheat and with all this genetic material, how do you kind of like weed through it, to get to the things that you really want? Like what are those things that you're really looking for, you know, in the help of Eric's team to have all that genetic information?
Yeah, so a great question. I think that as you begin to think about, you know, what you would like to develop within a certain plant like buckwheat, you know, there are obvious indicators of its potential as far as what's there currently in crops that we know here in Wisconsin that we've planted, things like anthocyanins, which offer, you know, usually the bright, vibrant reds and purple colors you see in small berry crops like strawberries and raspberries, to non-colored components of phenolics, things like rutin and quercetin, very strong antioxidants, other, you know, starches that are unique to the buckwheat plant itself. So there are lots of possible phytochemicals within the plant that you could breed for. And what I think is most fascinating is, you know, as a scientist, I have, you know, an ambition to really develop a high concentration of a certain phytochemical for a health benefit. But that's not the whole story. You also need to make that plant, as you develop it, agronomically feasible to produce on a large scale. So you have to balance, you know, the desires and wishes of a high concentration phytochemical with the fact that it's disease resistant, has a fairly decent yield to be grown on our farm. So it's really a balance of the farm knowledge and equipment and process with really the phytochemical potential of that plant.
Another crop that is interesting, and we were looking at it today, is hemp, right? And I think hemp is something interesting because, you know, obviously we're looking for a lot of the phytocannabinoids, but to the point of being sturdy and making sure that it, you know, survives wind and rain and those things. I mean, what are the things for hemp for both of you that would help, you know, to, you know, utilize the system to really make a difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think from my standpoint, you know, there are quite a wide profile of phytocannabinoids that really constitute a whole food, something that we're really, you know, we believe that the benefit of the plant is not just, you know, one particular molecule such as CBD, but really balancing not only the phytocannabinoids in, say, one particular plant, but maybe the benefits of multiple strains, you know, combined together offer you a benefit above and beyond just one particular plant with one particular high concentration of a phytochemical.
The CBD right now is kind of the hot topic. It's what the public sees as so valuable, right? But as well, when you look at the other cannabinoids, there are important ones. And then you also have the layers of terpenes too as well, which the terpenes are really important for a lot of health benefits, right? And potential for, you know, therapeutic. So when you talk about nutraceuticals, right, in a plant, a hemp has a lot of that potential as well. So I think when you kind of look at the ability to take multiple strains and strains that are going to be good for CBD, but then you can start piling on other strains that might have limonene and different types of essential kind of oil type compounds in them that can do a lot of good, right? And so as we've seen, you know, you take a hemp plant, it does really well at producing a lot of biomass and material. And so when you consider the ability for it to create a lot of material on a small land area with little input, it's a pretty exciting process to think about, like, and definitely be able to convert that bio machine into creating a lot of really cool compounds that can have health benefits in a lot of ways.
So we talked about buckwheat, we talked about hemp, and we looked at oats too today. And oats are one that are, you know, a really interesting aspect and one that we're trying to do a lot of different things. But how do oats fit into this kind of same concept.
Yeah, as Brandon would teach me, right, oats have unique antioxidants and have anthrahamides, right? And so there's no other crop. Oat is Avena. It's the genus Avena, so avenanthramides come from oats. But oats, I think that's the most underappreciated of the common grains, right? I almost like it's not common anymore. It's becoming kind of uncommon. We were just out in the field with the farm staff, and it was really kind of cool to listen to them tell me the stories of, my dad used to grow oats here in Wisconsin, and same thing with my dad. He would tell you, my dad, we used to grow oats on the farm in Minnesota, and you don't see that anymore. It's corn and soybean, right? And so you start to think about oats, though. I mean, oats already have a heart healthy claim, right? I mean, you think about the products that have taken advantage of heart health, the ability to lower cholesterol, right, comes about with that. And I don't think it's as simple as just, you have compounds and soluble fibers like beta-glucan. You have compounds like Avena anthramides, but you also have other things in oats that can be very beneficial when you talk about the vitamin E content and some of the fatty acid content that comes about with oats. So when you look at them from a macronutrient perspective over the other grains, I mean, there's advantages, right? And then the other thing, they don't produce glutens and hordeans and things like that. They have avenins at a very small level, but those have been shown in the research to be very, very minimal at reactive at all with a gluten sensitivity or an IBS or anything like that. So they also they're kind of a better crop or a grain crop for those things too. And I think the other thing, it's much like wheat. You have the Avena genus, which is made up of several species. So, sativa is the common oat that we think about that, everybody eats. But when you look at the ancestry of oat, even in particularly, there's two centers of diversity. There's on both of the northern tips of Africa. And so if you look at just how they've emerged, there's several species, whether it's a different species in Ethiopia that they've dealt with that have higher protein contents and different macronutrient loads. Or if you think about even its migration through Portugal, where you would have these Brevis type oats up into obviously the countries we know about, like in Scotland and England, where you have even another type of species of oats. And fascinating to me as I talked to one of these pioneers I talked about earlier, Mike Leggett, who was a pioneer when it comes to like oat ancestry and kind of the history of global oats. And he has shared with me at length just the idea that oats are such an important thing because during some of the hardest times in England's history, oats were the staple food that got them through some really tough times whenever they didn't have anything else to eat. And so you kind of think about that. It was a horse fodder, but yet whenever it really mattered, it was a human fodder, right? Mm-hmm. Why was that? Well, it was able to grow through some pretty harsh environments and still produce yield and grain. So it's very easy to grow. And then the other thing, it was high in fat content. So the caloric content has a higher level of that, where that was needed under kind of, ration kind of environments. And it's funny because that's what makes oats not a great choice for horses today, right? It's so nutrient dense, energy dense, that if you feed it to your horse and the horse isn't pulling a plow, it gets hot. And so the fuel has got too much octane for the horse and the horse gets hot, right? And so they call it hot, but it's just going to put on a lot of weight, right? And not be a good horse. And so that kind of leads to, it's got pretty potent calorie content too. So I think it's an untapped resource, or it's a resource that we need to bring back, right, in a way to our agricultural system.
It's interesting, in herbal medicine, they also talk about oats. And so, herbalists will use oats too for the bitters and for adaptogen. So it's a kind of an interesting, long history of a medicinal food. So you're using some interesting technology that I think my 16-year-old would probably find pretty exciting too, in the drone technology to help understand how the plants are growing. Can you talk a little bit more about how the drone really can be effective and how, we're talking about heirloom earlier and now we're talking about like high tech and how did those things marry together is kind of an interesting.
Yeah. Sarah, I think it's a good point. And what I would say, first of all, is us as a company. So we went down this road of UAVs and remote sensing and how do we help our ability to measure what the plant is saying, right? So I've heard this said, you know, from funny in a way, the wearable companies and the high-tech companies out in Silicon Valley, if you ask the question, what's the best sensor in the world? It's the living things in the world. And so when you kind of think about what is my soil health doing, what is my plant doing, it lets you know what it's doing. And people can listen and go, oh, this guy's kind of wacky, right? But it's not. It's not wacky because it's plants reflect light. They use light to create energy, right? And carbohydrates and everything else. That they have little machines and reactors in them that do that from sunlight. And when they're not healthy or they're not performing well, they change, that reflectance changes. What it emits out changes. What it absorbs changes because those reactors aren't working at peak efficiency, right? And so that for us, we caught on and said, hey, that's interesting. The problem is there was this big promise of UAV and drone technology, right? That it was going to do everything for you. You would just launch a drone and everything would be great. And it would come back and tell you everything the plants were telling you. And so everybody thought, oh, this is going to be amazing. Well, then those hit the market and then they got in the field and it didn't do even half what it promised it could do. And what happens with this technology is like anything else, early adopting cultures like the ones in the United States, all of a sudden those technologies go into the trough of disillusionment, right? That's a very common chart for scientists. And so for us, it's like, so now we're trying to understand this technology. We build the drones, we build the cameras for that very specific reason. But it's like the relationship that we have with Standard Process and the farm crew, it's those relationships that will help us, what I say, bring that technology out of the trough of disillusionment and to its place of reality. Like, where does it really augment a person? And so it really comes back into the ability to augment an individual to do their job better, right? It doesn't take over their job, it augments them. And so as we've been working with the farm crew and everything else, it's the questions we ask, okay, if I'm gonna launch a drone and I'm gonna image this, what is the data that I really need and how quickly and efficiently can I get that information back? And so the way we do it is we allow those images to be taken by the drone and then we build software algorithms on the back end that are trained by trained individuals in the field that go in and measure those things in the field. Now, to your question, what does that do in a high-tech world? Well, I just kind of threw out some numbers earlier about, you know, 200, 300, 400 of these plots in the field. And these are like 6x5 plots of a variety. And if we replicate those, we have a lot of those plots. So you can get up to these really large numbers where you got to take detailed evaluations on every one of these plots. And that's very time-consuming. And as the person's in the field taking these notes, it becomes very biased from fatigue or different raters to cover that many plots. This is where this technology really comes in well, because now you can use these augmented technologies like drones and cameras and vision, where it can fly above the plots at a very high level. It can image all these different spectral bands. I mean, we see red, green, and blue, right? So we go from like 0 to 720, right? We can't quite see down to zero. Everything becomes white, right? But we see this narrow range of reflectance around us where the camera can see much deeper than that, right? It's got almost like a superhuman strength. But it can also fly over there, and then the machine can cut out every one of those individual plots very quickly. And then it can measure all these things that it's been trained to do by the human in the field. And so now, feasibly, you can do what took days to do. You can do that in a matter of hours, right, with the drone, and it's much more precise and it's not biased. So now the researcher can choose, okay, I can use that technology to help me understand all these other ratings, and I can then go in and pick and choose what I go in and look at after that to make the data that much more robust. And now I can apply that really robust set of data to that genetic data and get really good predictive models. So I can create the Jarvis for Iron Man, right? That now I can just ask Jarvis, if I need a buckwheat or an oat or a hemp variety that's going to grow really well on my farm with these conditions, which one would I choose? And it could tell me, choose this one, because it's got all that rich data in it. And then if I say, well, but I need to go higher than that, well, tell me these are the parents you need to cross to bring those kids together to then select one of its second or third or fourth grandchildren, right, or great-great-grandchildren that's going to give you what you need. But that starts at this level of collecting really good information at a very acute time early on. And that's really hard to do when it gets that big. So these kind of high-tech technologies will do that. And the other thing, Sarah, that I think is really fascinating about this is what you said. You said, my kids would love it, right? And let's face it, like I was making the comment to Christine today, and I thought this was really good. We were talking about like having to overcome certain things. And she was talking about, we could build, take this, implement, and we could do this. I said, yeah, because you're an innovator. And she's like, looked at me kind of funny. And I'm going, farmers have always been the innovators.
Right.
When we look at history, like they're the most innovative people in the world, right? They've learned how to feed us all in a changing environment. They are innovators. And so what's exciting to me is, we've kind of gone away from that. The kids don't, agriculture's not cool anymore, right? It's like iPhones and games are cool, and drones for recreation are cool. Well, now we're bringing that technology back, right? And we're bringing kind of Iron Man into agriculture, and we're pairing that with these farmers who are innovators, and you're seeing this catapult of innovation, I think, occurring. But we're going to get some of those kids back, right? We're going to get some of those young minds back into agriculture. And they're going to be able to solve these bigger food challenges that we're seeing in the future. And the things like Brandon's talking about, of how do we not only create a crop with high yield, but this macronutrient density per acre, right? Because we're going to have a shrinking land mass too,
right?
Because more and more people, right? So they will figure that out. And that's the exciting part. So how do we draw them in? They're going to know more about this technology than we are. And we're starting to see that come back, which is exciting to me. It's kind of like that chain reaction, right?
You know, what most people are aware of in, say, the wheat world as a parallel, you know, there are all sorts of like ancient varieties of wheat that are appreciated for their nutritional content. And I think that's been done, whether you know it or not, in the barley world as well, more for malting and amylase content, starch content, for really hitting some great strains. But, you know, this is unique in the fact that we are now taking the oat and developing it for its nutritional content, which is really something that hasn't had a whole lot of focus. So exciting to be a part of.
Well, this was a really exciting conversation today, and I hope we have more. Thank you both for all this insight into really how do we take something so ancient and bring it into the 21st century in a way that really can change how we address nutrition as a whole and continue to feed the world. So thank you for your time.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. Dave Hogsett here. And I hope you enjoyed that podcast featuring the absolutely brilliant minds of Dr. Metzger and Dr. Jackson. That podcast was such an important reminder to me that in a time when genetic engineering can potentially do a lot of harm to our bodies and the environment with GMO foods, that you can also optimize the genetic potential and nutrient contents of a plant with completely natural methods in modern farming technology. And as a clinical nutrition practitioner, it was really exciting to hear that these advancements are being used to maximize the nutrient and phytochemical content of some of our most important superfoods, including buckwheat, oats, and hemp. So I just want to say thank you to Dr. Jackson and Dr. Metzger for working so hard to use these advancements to get the most benefit out of our foods. Because as you know, there are a lot of people and a lot of companies out there that have a very different philosophy than these two doctors. And they've decided that using genetically modified organisms for greater crop yield and pesticide resistance is the only way to go. It's pretty sad. And just to put some perspective on how much GMO we're exposed to now, in 2018, 94% of all soy planted was genetically modified. 94%. And what about corn? Corn is the biggest crop in the U.S., and 92% of the corn planted is genetically modified. But even if you don't eat obvious sources of soy and corn, these two foods are also used as a major food source for livestock and poultry. So you're probably getting secondhand GMOs by eating conventional poultry, beef, and dairy. And then you can look at all the other soy and corn products like soybean oil. Let this number really sink in. The average American's caloric intake is about 8% soybean oil. 8%. That's a staggering percentage of our diet to be a genetically modified oil. And that's to say nothing of the lopsided omega-6 to omega-3 ratio it helps create in our body. It's in packaged foods, salad dressing, used to fry foods at restaurants. It's everywhere. Same with corn oil. GMO corn oil is in so many foods now. And what about corn products like cornstarch and high fructose corn syrup? So unless someone is consciously avoiding the standard American diet, they're getting a pretty good amount of genetically modified corn and soy on a daily basis. But don't worry, it gets worse. Our number one vegetable we consume in the US now, potatoes, is also commonly planted as a GMO crop. Rice, sugar beets, alfalfa, cotton, and canola, as in canola oil, which you know, like corn and soy oil, is found in so many foods today. In fact, it's estimated that up to 80% of packaged foods in the US have GMOs. So what are the actual consequences of eating GMO foods? Well, there's lots of controversy, a lot of different opinions, but regardless of what the actual genetically modified organism does in our body, I think we can all agree that ingesting a lot of the weed killer glyphosate is not a good thing. And when you make GMO crops like corn and soy specifically for the purpose of being resistant to Roundup glyphosate application, guess what? You're going to get more glyphosate in those foods. And one of the biggest health dangers that there's a pretty strong link to now with glyphosate consumption is a disruption of your gut microbiome. And we're still just scratching the surface of how the microbiome affects every area of our health. Of course, our digestion, but also our immunity, our mood, because it has such a strong link with neurological health. The microbiome affects everything, and glyphosate can be a very serious threat to a healthy microbiome. So a study that's hot off the presses in Science Daily from November 2020 found that up to 54% of the bacteria in our microbiome can be sensitive to the effects of glyphosate. Glyphosate can affect 54% of the bacteria in our microbiome. So even if the GMO is safe, the glyphosate baggage that usually comes with it can definitely mess with our gut bacteria. And probiotics have always been important, but they're more important than ever before to help level the playing field in our gut microbiome. The microbiome has enough assaults on it with sugar, antibiotics, chlorine, and lack of prebiotic fiber that we should be eating. We don't need an extra gut-disrupting weed killer in our daily diet. So anybody who's not eating fermented foods can definitely benefit from a probiotic or prebiotic supplement. And the best is when they're actually combined. And another lesser-known microbiome-supporting food you heard mentioned in the podcast is buckwheat. And that's because of the high concentration of phytochemicals, especially the phenolics that support healthy bacteria in your gut. And that's just one more reason I literally give every single patient of mine a supplement with buckwheat. So the research that Dr. Metzger and Dr. Jackson mentioned to maximize the phytochemical content in buckwheat is so important. I believe another food that's more important than ever before to help us handle these new GMO and glyphosate problems is cruciferous vegetables. Things like broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and my favorite cruciferous vegetable for supporting detoxification, Spanish black radish. The glucosinolates in cruciferous vegetables are one of the most important tools we have to make us more resilient to really this modern chemistry experiment that's going on in our bodies. So if patients aren't eating cruciferous vegetables regularly, they can definitely benefit from a cruciferous vegetable supplement. Again, now more than ever before. Now, if you want a really good resource to learn more about where we get all this GMO and glyphosate exposure, check out EWG.org. That's the Environmental Working Group website. There's some pretty sobering new research on there about the high levels of glyphosate found in different brands of hummus and lots of other depressing info. But we need to pass on this kind of information to our patients if we want them to understand how important it is to detoxify and to support your microbiome. So buying 100% certified organic food is really the only way to ensure you're not getting GMO food or getting secondhand GMO food from feeding corn and soy to livestock and poultry, because there's still no labeling requirement of GMOs, not until 2022. So support your body's own ability to handle the glyphosate baggage in our GMO food, because as hard as you try, you're going to be exposed. And we can thank people like Dr. Metzger and Dr. Jackson for naturally enhancing the superfoods we need to help our bodies thrive in this very stressful world. So with that, I'll see you after the next podcast.
Thank you to Eric and Brandon for being our guests this episode. Eric is the Chief Technical Officer for 25.2 Solutions and the architect of the company's Native Crop Lab. To learn more about 25.2 Solutions, go to www.25-2.com.